Thank you very much, Bruce, for this talk, and thank you very much for your book. Let me begin with a confidence that I feel deeply honored to be the debater of Bruce Ackermann's. Guy Vaudel, our president, has said enough words on his work, and I don't want to repeat again what he has already said. But I would just like to add something a little bit personal, which could explain better than anything else why I feel honored to be here today discussing this book. When I was in Yale in 1994 for a week as a visiting fellow, I spent some days in the beautiful library of the Yale Law School. I studied there and I read the book, I discovered the book of Bruce Ackermann, We the People Foundation, first volume. And there I have had a strong impression that the way by which Ackermann was doing constitutional law was, from my point of view, the best way to study this law and to investigate our field. It was apparently constitutional history, but it was in fact more than that. It was constitutional law, constitutional theory, political philosophy, and political science. In other words, it was a kind of constitutional law I was fond of, and I didn't find it in France. If I share with you these memories, it's not to stage myself instead of discussing Ackermann's conference, but rather to emphasize the fact that the same observation can be made about his new book, Decline and Fall of the American Republic, maybe an allusion to Gibbon's work. It reveals the same qualities in the sense of constitutional realism, which is rather seldom encountered, and which explains that all his books are worth reading and always stimulating. As you have yet understood, my comments relate less to the conference, which has just been delivered, than to the book. When I was thinking of my comments, I had said to myself that I'm perhaps, sure, not the better debater, not only because I can't be considered as a specialist of the American constitutional law, I am not, but also because I lack critical sense when I read the books of Ackermann. But I'm sure that the audience will have more critics than I have to address him. It seems fair to underline first the merits of the books and its great interest. I shall see later on the critical remarks which can be made. So I begin with the merits of his book, its interest. This book is an essay on the constitutional situation of the US, and it is, in a way, I found it, an alarming book. It tells us that American constitutional law has forgotten its constitutional ethos, the idea of rule of law, and has too often succumbed to the delights of illegality. The book is largely based on the classical division, a critical diagnosis, and a kind of prognostic. It describes the evils of excessive presidentialism, and it gives some remedies to save the American democracy in our century. This is the main goal of the book. The first great interest of this book for a French lawyer is to give most valuable insights to our knowledge of the American political system. And Bruce told that in the first factor, all these factors, with this risk of charismatic president. I have to say that the information which are given don't concern only constitutional law in strict terms, but also the political system as a whole. Because we know that Bruce Ackermann doesn't separate the two fields, he gives us a very thoughtful aperçu of his new democracy, which is not only a mass media democracy, but which is endangered by two phenomena: the danger of a victory of a demagogue and the end of a professionalized journalism. The president is ironically defined as, I like it, demagogue-in-chief, instead of commander-in-chief is demagogue-in-chief. And for a French citizen, it reminds something. The second grand interest of the book, and it's very apparent, is to give for us foreigners who ignore the details of the American government a new account, an updated account of this system, constitutional system. We knew, of course, a little about the use of emergency powers after September 11 and about the institutional effects of a war on terrorism. But the reader of this book learns much more about the presidency and his administrative staff. It's not only the civil bureaucracy, but also the military bureaucracy. One of the most disturbing facts revealed in this book is the politicization of the legal staff and also what we call the hyper-politicization of the army, of the military. It describes the end of civilian control and the traditional subjection of the army to civilian power is highly challenged by new developments. We see here where lies the great force of Ackermann's achievements. It studies the living constitution and it tries to find the shift of a power in the institution. It's always the idea of institutional ideas and not personal critical. He doesn't lose time studying the Congress and concentrates his study on the executive and the way the executive puts a pressure on the Supreme Court, which appears here rather important against the political demands of executive. We discover, meanwhile, many similarities between the current US system and the French democracy. The common word, of course, is presidency, or maybe better, the term of unilateralism. Like in international relations, the president of the USA tries to forget the rules of law and to act alone outside the law or beside the law. The impression is curious for a French lawyer. He has a feeling that US constitutional lawyers discover something for us which is well known: the domination of a reason of state, the retreat of the rule of law, and the power not only of the president, but of the presidency, of the staff. Some passages of the book give to the French reader an impression of déjà vu. But America is an empire, and France is a little country, so it's more worrying. The last great interest of the book, from my point of view, lies in the third part of the book, which proposes some remedies. Bruce Ackermann takes some risks. His picture of a system is frightening, in many ways. With his new presidency, I quote him, dominating the political scene, with formidable powers of mass manipulation in extremist causes, end of quotation. A leadership of plebiscitarian nature without the checks and balances. He proposed remedies and wants a conversation to begin about the new design of a constitutional system. His claim is clear: the American citizen, and first, if I have understood, the American scholars, must find new solutions, modern solutions, more attuned to our times, to revitalize the checks and balances, and to be loyal to the founding fathers' legacy. Some of his claims were here already quoted by Louis Vogel: derivation day, supermajority escalator, and reform of the electoral college. But the rule makes sense. As a debater, I would betray my job. I was not paid, but it's my job. If I was unable to find some critics to be addressed to this work. Don't worry, Bruce, I can't find a few, but I hope that they might be useful for continuing the conversation you ask for in your book. The main thesis about the unbound presidency contains another thesis, so I read that, which is not central, but which astonished the French reader. Barack Obama has not completely reversed the Bush axis. And you wrote in your conclusion, the president, Obama, is entirely oblivious to the danger we have been canvassing. End of quotation. This would then be my first question to you. Are you not too harsh with Obama, who has many challenges to meet, only one of which is the constitutional challenge, and a secondary one, given the current economic climate? To enter in such a constitutional reform might also mean alienating the future electorate which his office depends on. So that's the first question. Second point, concerning the reform of the Electoral College, you support the Popular Sovereignty Initiative, which tries to bypass the constraint of an amendment by an interstate compact. You consider that the current system is not democratic enough because of a federal structure. And with other scholars, like Achille Amar, your colleague of Yale, you claim that this reform, which replaces the Electoral College by the direct popular vote, will be more democratic, enabling a more important participation of the American citizens in the presidential election. I can, of course, follow this argument and understand it. But here's my point. If you fear for the next for our century an emergence of plebiscitarian regime, wouldn't you think that a mode of reinforcement of popular sovereignty along these lines would have, as an effect, an increase of the risk of extremist presidency. In other words, with this reform of the electoral college, you might eliminate the federal dimension, which constitutes, in the US like in other countries, or other federal countries, an essential component of checks and balances. So my second question. Third question, your idea of a supreme executive tribunal is very attractive, if I understand it. If it would allow a fast review of some presidential decisions or decrees, you might have been inspired by the experience of French Conseil d'État as it emerged from some of your footnotes, but I have some doubts concerning the feasibility of this reform. Firstly, the French system, as you know, is a form of objective review, whereas, as you mentioned it, the Supreme Court system has a typical common law procedure in that it requires a subjective element, a subjective right, which must have been infringed. How can you import such a system without provoking fierce resistance and maybe incoherence? Secondly, how do you imagine the relation between this new court, this Supreme Executive Tribunal, and the Supreme Court? You write that the latter would have a final call, that is to say, the final say. Many problems can arise because of this duality of courts, resulting in potential conflicts of legitimacies. If the Supreme Court may review the decision of the Supreme Executive Tribunal, then this tribunal can no longer be considered as supreme. And my last remark, my last remark is the following one. In your book, there is a great absent, which is the Congress. You talk, of course, of the Supreme Court as a possible counterpower, and you explain, very interestingly, that it is no longer able to redress the excesses of the president, of the presidency. But you seem to deliberately ignore the Congress, except for the confirmation of a Senate for presidential nomination, as if a reform of the constitutional machinery of the US could be thinkable without a new design of the two chambers. It is for me an enigma, and how could you explain this mere fact? So thank you for your attention.